Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And as always, a reminder for those that are with us live, go ahead and hop in the chat room. You'll find there at the bottom of the show page, join in with the usual suspects. That's your location. If you have some observations about the show or some questions you would like for Eagle One or myself to direct towards our guest, go ahead and roll in your ideas there, and we'll do our best to fold them in as we go along. And if we happen to sound like we're going to go a little bit over the full hour, if you're joining us live, it will die at the 60-minute mark, but you can come back and grab the archive or the podcast on iTunes and any after show. Couple of minutes of conversation, you can catch it there, and finishes all the last comments that we may have. And now let's get on with the show. Our guest for the full hour today is a returning guest that we had on earlier this year, David Sears. We had him on to discuss his earlier book, Such Men as These, The Story of Navy Pilots Who Flew the Deadly Skies Over Korea. Well, he has a new book out, kind of going back in time a bit, and it's sure to become a quick favorite for anybody who has read about this subject, is enthusiastic about the subject, because he's packaged it together, I think, in a really nice way. His latest book is Pacific Air, How Fearless Flyboys, Peerless Aircraft, and Fast Flat Tops Conquered the Skies in the War with Japan. And David, welcome back to Midrats.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, first question I wanted to ask you is the battle in the Pacific and the air battle, I mean, it's been written about a lot. We've had movies done about it, and it seems to be a subject that's been covered a lot. But what got you to the point you said that there's a way that I want to tell the story, a way I want to put it together? What did you reach that point, and what are you trying to achieve with the book that perhaps other authors haven't quite put together in the same way?
Well, let me begin by saying I'm trying to sell more books than they have, but in terms of the topic itself, I think one angle that was a little bit different was to look at the development of the aircraft as well as the exploits of the pilots. So I kind of looked at, in this case, at Grumman Aircraft and the way that they developed aircraft and put them on the line to be flown by these pilots. I think that's a slightly different angle. I think also I brought my book to a conclusion at the first battle of the Philippine Sea, combination of the Marianas Turkey shoot and the what's called the Flight Beyond Darkness. Mission Beyond Darkness, and use that as the conclusion of the book when really there was another many months of war to go. But I saw that as the kind of the culmination of the control of the skies by the Americans in the Pacific War.
As you start out the book, the pilots are flying, U.S. Navy pilots are flying biplanes, and Grumman, at the point of the actual start of the book, I guess it's just beginning to get into mono-wing aircraft. Could you kind of describe how that evolved and
right.
What the purpose of all that was?
Yeah, Grumman was at the in the years before World War II was a classic technology startup. It was the residue of a company called Loening Aircraft, which had kind of specialized in civilian amphibian aircraft and did some work for the Navy. And when Loening was was sold and moved from the New York area to Pennsylvania, a key group of individuals from that company broke off and started Grumman Aircraft. And their, you know, their claim to fame, their first work they did for the Navy was actually to produce a retractable wheel mechanism for an amphibian plane, and they were able to do it and to do it in a way that made the aircraft both stronger and lighter. And the Navy wanted that, wanted Grumman to produce the same mechanism for aircraft that were being built for the Navy by Boeing. And Boeing was kind of the prime one of the prime contractors for the Navy in the pre-war era. And you know, Roy Grumman made you know, one of those key decisions in life, saying that no, we won't do it if it's for a Boeing aircraft, but we'd like to incorporate it into a Grumman aircraft that we could produce for the Navy. And that was kind of their foot in the door with that association with the Navy.
You know, like a lot of kids of my age and other generations, I had, using the 1/72nd scale models, I had all the Grumman aircraft starting from, you know, Fertile Myrtle all the way up through the Hellcat. And you can see when you make the models or you look at the pictures or whatever, there was all the way back to the beginning, all the way through to the end of World War II, there was a certain set of common characteristics to Grumman aircraft that really endeared itself to the Navy. You know, they're a little fat, a little stubby, but they're very rugged, and they really were evolutionary in many respects, and that Grumman was always building and improving and not really creating things out of whole cloth. While you look at other companies, you can kind of see it a little bit in the evolution from the Aero Cobra to the Mustang, which was kind of a similar evolution. But what was it about the Grumman culture that, that gave their aircraft that almost sense of family and commonality?
Right. You know, first of all, I think it helped a lot that Roy Grumman was a naval aviator himself, not one of the better naval aviators, but he had gone through Navy flight training and earned his wings of gold. So I think that kind of helped in having a sense of what the Navy needed and trying to produce to those standards. And I think that the company he built back then, although it's gone through a lot of changes since then, obviously, and has now been absorbed by Boeing, but it was kind of an artisan type of company, a kind of a craftsman approach as opposed to a mass production approach. And I think the thing that they brought to the Navy was the knowledge that even in the with advancing technologies in the aircraft carrier, most of the Navy flyers were still kind of learning their way through this, and their planes had to be rugged, you know, in terms of landing gear, for example, to be able to land and take off from these aircraft carrier decks. And also, you have to understand that at this time, in the early 30s, mid 30s, the communications gear that were aboard these aircraft were either non-existent or pretty basic, and without radar or any reliable communications, the aircraft that these pilots flew had to be able to stand up and make their way back. So it was kind of a different environment from aviation of any other kind, and I think Roy Grumman had a real appreciation of that, and his workers built to that standard.
As the at the start of the book, I think there were three main U.S. aircraft carriers: the Saratoga,
I think the Lexington was in there, and And the Langley, Langley was probably the first. Maybe there was another. The details there kind of escaped me at the moment.
Well, one of the things that I got from reading the book, which I thought was interesting, and many people may have missed, was that when Pearl Harbor happened, we actually had a number of aircraft carriers under construction,
right,
at various stages. And can you kind of go into that a little bit? And were they?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll follow up.
Yeah, I think the number of aircraft carriers available at the beginning of the war, and of course, you know, the aircraft carriers that were in the Pacific happened to not be involved in Pearl Harbor. Actually, the Japanese sunk the wrong portion of the fleet, and the aircraft carriers escaped. But I think there were, if memory serves me, 7 aircraft carriers on hand, 3 of them on the East Coast and 4 in the Pacific. And the next generation of aircraft carriers, the Essex-class carrier, were under design and construction, but it would be another, you know, year and a half to 2 years before they could make it to the Pacific and actually begin to participate in the war. So there was a period there where the resources that the Navy had, the limited aircraft carriers and the limited aircraft as well, had to hold their own or try to hold their own against a superior, at the time, Japanese fleet and certainly Japanese naval aircraft.
Yeah, my follow-up on that was going to be about the Essex class and some of the Jeep carriers or the smaller carriers. I mean, were those the Essex class, as you said, were under development at the time of the start of the war? But how about the Jeep type carriers? Were they also being worked on, or was that
I think the Jeep carriers were actually developed initially to support the war in the Atlantic, to help the convoys protect themselves with aircraft against the submarine threat. And I think that came first, and then the thought that, well, we can use these light carriers to these escort carriers, which are really built on merchant hulls, to ferry aircraft out to the Pacific, and then from there they became part of the amphibious invasion forces, freeing up the fleet carriers to take part in fleet actions while the escort carriers supported the amphibious invasions. So I think the sequence was to protect the convoys in the North Atlantic first, and then the application for the Pacific War came next.
I always found interesting, and again, you know, kind of sticking a little bit with the pre-war, is the time compression. It's easy to lose track of how short the times are here. If you look at, from 1935 to 1941, there was a huge competition between Boeing, Grumman, Chance Vought, you know, Curtiss, Brewster, and you went from biplanes to monoplanes. This was all in an era before anything, you know, fast communications was airmail on a Jenny biplane. You might be able to get a couple of words off on a telegraph, and your high technology was a really nice quality drafting table. But the incredible jump in technology in that 6-year period was such that, you know, especially when you got to the beginning of right before Pearl Harbor, if the Japanese had attacked us, you know, 6 or 8 months earlier, we would have luckily to have had any Wildcats at whatever would have been Midway or anything else, because the Brewster Buffalo was still the primary fighter for up till, I think, early 41. What was it, that competition that created so much of that advancement? Because it often seems that the Navy requirements were put out as X, and many times that competition created X plus one, a real high quality. Once they got what they wanted, already something new was in the barrel.
Yeah, I think that the competition didn't come to fruition until basically a couple years before the war. If you look through the period right in the early stages of the Great Depression and through the mid-30s, I think all the aircraft companies were struggling. It was only as war became more and more inevitable that the pressure was put on to develop aircraft and other, you know, any technology for the war. And it's it's one of those interesting things, at least in the case of Grumman, the usual assumption at the time is that, you know, once a war starts, you kind of fight with the technology that you have at hand. In other words, technology development gives way to manufacturing. And that was pretty much the case with the Japanese. Their development of the Zero aircraft, a monoplane, great monoplane aircraft, had occurred in the mid-1930s, and although they developed other aircraft, you know, going into World War II and through World War II, none of those other aircraft really reached the stage of production that the United States was able to do with its technology. And in the case of Grumman, you know, they were going through various models of the Wildcat until they got, I don't forget which model it was, but and we're talking about the very early stages of the war, you know, Grumman made the decision to embark on what was really an entirely new aircraft. It may have looked a little bit similar, but in terms of technology and refinements, it was a new aircraft in the Hellcat. And they were able to develop that aircraft and put it into production right in the middle of World War II. So that was kind of unique.
One of the things you've done in the book is juxtapose the Japanese fighter pilot with the training that was going on with the Americans, and I thought that was interesting. Why did the Japanese, or how did the Japanese get the lead on developing such a fine aircraft as what we call a Zero?
Well, they'd been, you know, have to understand that the Japanese had been fighting a war on mainland China since early in the 1930s. So from a production standpoint and from a tactical standpoint and from a training standpoint, their pilots in their aircraft were kind of honed to a fine edge, so that when, you know, and obviously more or less started the war, obviously, with the attack on Pearl Harbor, you know, they got to set the terms of preparation. So both their fleet and their aircraft and their pilots were considerably, if not considerably better than what the United States had, and certainly better prepared in terms of having been fighting all this time a major war on mainland China.
Yeah, I like that as well, how you wove in a professional that both sides highly respect, Saburo Sakai, and his experience of his training and how demanding the Japanese were, especially, you know, before the war, on who could be a pilot and the degree of their training. And then at the very end of the war, when they were just concerned with getting wheels up and being able to pull the trigger. But another thing I found out in your book that I did not know, I had always grown up with the Wildcat. That was a great airplane, because unlike the Zero, it had all this armor and the self-sealing fuel tanks, and the Zero never did. But I didn't know that when originally developed, that the Wildcat did not have self-sealing fuel tanks. It did not have armor. And a matter of fact, the Navy Air Establishment did not want that because of the extra added weight and decreased range. But when the realities of combat came in, improvise, adapt, overcome, that American habit of changing things as required came in, and they did that. Well, the Japanese really didn't adopt that with their Zero. Was that same type of mentality seen in other places in aircraft development that broke out the Americans versus the Japanese?
I think, you know, the Japanese pilots, at least the ones that I've read about, were, you know, early in the war, were incredibly skilled. And when it came to an aircraft like the Zeke, you know, their pilots didn't want to have anything to do with armor. And actually, a lot of them didn't want to have anything to do with radios because of the extra weight. American pilots disposition, but the self-sealing fuel tanks, the pilot armor, were things that, you know, you couldn't stop the production line. That was what was being churned out. So they had to fly them, and they had initially a disadvantage against Japanese aircraft, but they had the fact that the plane was more survivable than the Japanese, and that made a big difference to them, especially to a cadre of pilots that wasn't yet experienced in fighting. You know, the kill ratios between the Wildcat and the Zero were roughly even, but production was going to outstrip the production of the Zero, and eventually, of course, the Hellcat came in, and that production outstripped the Zero as well. So it was a matter of holding on until things got better, working with what you got, and learning your tactics and improving.
Well, speaking of tactics, I mean, one of the other things you hit on is the development of tactics, I guess, that were far different than those used in World War One. Is it John? I would never get his name right. Is it John Thatch? Was it the
Thatch? Right. Yeah, Jimmy Thatch. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Could you kind of describe what his innovation was? What we call, is that the Thatch weave? Is that what we call it?
Yeah. You know, when World War II began, at least for the Americans, they were still using formations and tactics that were kind of reminiscent of World War One, and it meant, for example, that you know, kind of the indivisible unit of a flying formation, a section included three planes, a lead plane and a plane on either wing of the leader, and basically flying at a kind of close formation. And the thing that Thatch was one of the early squadron commanders in World War II. He kind of realized that flying those tight formations, especially into battle, created as much danger for the people flying them as the enemy did. In other words, a pilot would have to watch out for his fellow aircraft in formation. So Thatch did a couple of things, or at least he embellished on a couple of things. First of all, the basic formation was changed to a two-plane section, which made it easier for a leader and wingman to keep track of each other. And then he increased the distance between the planes, increased it at least to the turning radius, so that the leader and the wingman could keep their eye on each other. And this weave, which is kind of hard to describe on the radio, but the fact was that if one plane was being attacked and the other noticed, the planes would automatically turn, leaving the attacking aircraft the choice of getting away or coming into the sights of the plane he wasn't attacking. So that was kind of a big change, and it was a way of kind of leveling the playing field, and the Thatch weave became a tactic certainly for propeller-driven aircraft that carried throughout the war.
Yeah, I found that really interesting that was all done pre-war, sitting in the kitchen with a bunch of matchsticks.
Yeah.
As his wife was fussing at him that he needed to get to sleep.
I think
we've all been there. She sounds like
yeah.
a great woman. There's also mentioned in Saburo Sakai, actually, in one of your descriptions of that, he found it very curious because, you know, his job having to attack the big American bombers, the B-17s. Before the war, the B-17 thought that it could attack shipping from high altitude. So that was a theory that did not work out very well once combat took place. In your research, were there some other good ideas and bad ideas from a tactics point of view before the war that either panned out or didn't pan out and they had to get rid of once they realized they weren't quite working?
Well, you know, in the case of the B-17s and bombers in general, I think it was learned during the war that when it came to attacking or defending against shipping, that vertical bombing was really trying to thread a needle. It was really impossible to do from 10,000 or 20,000 feet to land a bomb on a traveling ship. So I think that was fairly early recognized, although, you know, even by the time of the Battle of the Midway, I think if you look at the news reports from the time, the Army Air Force and their B-17 bombers claimed that, you know, they were the victors of the Battle of Midway from their vertical bombing, when actually it was the torpedo planes and especially the dive bombers, the Navy dive bombers, that actually that did the damage. So that was something that was a continuing dispute between the Navy and the Army Air Force. I mean, I think another, even in the early stages of the war, it was still it was kind of the World War One approach, where it was mano a mano in these dogfights, when really a dogfight, a single plane against another plane, was not the tactic to follow. It was to stick with your wingman and to gain vertical advantage and to make quick strikes and then get ready for the next one. So I think the whole philosophy and psychology of aerial combat had to change and did change.
In writing this book, did you see any indication of influence of what the Flying Tigers had been doing with their P-40s and any lessons they'd learned in fighting the Zeros that had been relayed to the U.S. Navy people?
Well, I think the Flying Tigers were, you know, the combated Zeros. I'm not sure how much luck they had. I didn't really research that part, but they were certainly sending out warnings to the rest of the U.S. to the U.S. military that this this aircraft was on the way, and I think it didn't take too long for Navy pilots to figure out ways that they could counter the Zero, even with the Wildcat. And of course, when the Hellcat came on the scene, people have said that the Hellcat was built specifically to counter the Zero. It did counter the Zero, but I think that's kind of claiming too much, because the aircraft was really under development and on its way before we had any experience with the Zero. I mean, I think the one thing that the Navy pilots did learn, and maybe this came from partially from the Flying Tigers and certainly from their own experience, the Japanese Zero was such a light and nimble aircraft, but when it got into a steep dive, there were real problems moving the ailerons. In other words, the control stick in the cockpit couldn't handle the flying surfaces to get them changed. So an easy way was, not an easy way, but a way to get away from a Zero in a combat situation was simply to go into a high-speed dive and then roll, because the Japanese plane, the pilot just couldn't control the control surfaces to follow.
Another one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is the fact that you rolled in some personality descriptions that, like in my opening question, distinguishes your book from others about the area. I think this is it. Because I found out about a personality that had totally slipped the other readings I had done. When you think of the interwar period, the people that really were trying to wake up the military establishment about the importance of aviation and the role it would play in the future, the first thing that comes to people's mind, of course, is Billy Mitchell. And I think it's kind of the fact that he was court-martialed and generally made an excessive nuisance of himself, and is seen as, the underdog against the system and fighting them, maybe a little more dramatic. And maybe that's why Mitchell was court-martialed. But the other character you bring in there is eventually, Vice Admiral Towers. And he was, back when he was Captain Towers, he created quite a stink, or was he Rear Admiral at this point, where he said, it is the aircraft carrier that will spearhead the action in the next war. If you could please talk about how he initially started out as an outspoken advocate, and then later, during congressional testimony, he seemed to have turned and had been brought in back to the collective.
Right, right.
And one of the congressional questioners demanded answers, quote, from Captain Jack Towers, and not
right.
from Admiral Towers, who is now
right.
taking orders from the
right.
line admirals. I
right.
thought that was a kind of flesh out that character that might not be very well known in the story that he played.
Well, not so much, Towers, but kind of the tradition that he represented. There were two types of naval aviators among the senior officers in the Navy. There were people like Towers and Mitcher, for example, who started their careers or early in their careers had been trained as naval aviators. And they were kind of slowly working their way up through the system during the 20s and 30s. I believe, I don't know the specific date, but at a certain point in time, the U.S. Navy, in its development of aircraft carriers, made it mandatory that officers who wanted to command aircraft carriers had to be air qualified. And this created a separate cadre of what were called, Pensacola admirals. And these were career officers, often in their 40s and sometimes even in their 50s, like Halsey, who either went through flight training or went through what was called, I believe, flight observation training, something like that. So they were kind of late to the party, and there was always a struggle during the war between aviators like Towers, who were getting to command level, and the Pensacola admirals who were in control of the fleet formations, and sometimes even the what were called the gun club, the captains and admirals who had their experience in battleships. So there was a real struggle between these two categories of officers, high-placed officers who were vying for control of this new fleet arm, the aircraft carriers. And Towers, up until early in the war, was kind of, always sniping from the sideline, saying, well, if aircraft carriers are going to have this, firmer role in the war, it has to be fully trained aviators that are in charge of them. And only when he was brought into the fold and became, I don't know the specific title, but it was kind of a deputy CNO type of role for aviation, suddenly he had to toe the line.
Has, I guess I was going to ask a question which was half formulated in my mind. Let's see if I can get it to work. We make a big deal about having... And in your book, it's also touched on having what you call the gun club admirals versus the aviation admirals, whether they were Pensacola admirals or otherwise.
Right.
And given that the tactics and use of the aircraft was changing so rapidly, would it have made a major difference in terms did it make a major difference in terms of what the flyers were being told to do out there as to who was actually in charge, or frosting?
Well, I guess the answer, the every answer to your half question is yes and no. I'm not sure that this struggle impeded or slowed down or expanded the timeline of the war all that much. But certainly while it was going on, there was a real conflict over the best use of the carriers and their flight groups. The aviators thought that the fast carriers should be detached from other fleet operations and go on the offensive, whereas the powers that be in the Navy wanted them to be part and parcel of the campaigns to capture the islands in the South and then the Central Pacific. It was only towards the end of the war that these fast carrier groups more and more got detached from the overall fleet and were able to be true offensive weapons. I mean, I think there was a race at that time towards the end of the war, the Navy wanting to end the war with its own planes over Japan versus the strategic bombers of the Army Air Force at the time. I think it made a difference probably in the course of the war, but not in the timeline of the war.
You're talking about the Pensacola admirals, and people read about World War II. Of course, they Admiral King is always in the background. He's kind of that little statue in the corner that everybody is all impressed with. I mean, he had a real eclectic background. Start off, traditional naval officer, went submarines, had an aviation background. He had all the warfare qualifications. But another thing I got out of your book that I kind of gotten hints at before, but really wasn't fleshed out in detail, is there were certain personality aspects of Admiral King that, from a 21st century perspective, even though this is still within living memory, really makes it perplexing that he made it to the levels he did, and his competence must have been incredible. Could you please talk a little bit about some of his aggressive writing he did at the War College that I think all our military bloggers should look at, and also his personal behavior in his work hard, play hard, we'll get along on Monday morning, a view of life.
Right. I guess probably he was a captain at the time on his way to higher things and went through the Naval War College. And he wrote a thesis that basically told it like it was, that the American style of government and the priorities of its citizens made the United States forever unprepared for war. So it was real kind of castigation of the government control, as ours is by civilians, and the failure to keep ever prepared for war. So I think that could have squelched his career a bit, but. He was really a towering figure in the war that doesn't get as much as many headlines as do people like Admiral Halsey. I mean, I think the working relationship that King had with Admiral Nimitz, they had a good relationship, but King saw Nimitz as what he called a fixer, because Nimitz had come out of the Bureau of Personnel and was really good at matching personalities to given situations. And King could be the bastard at the top, and Nimitz could be the intervening figure that would work with the admirals in the Pacific. And it was a great, great working combination. And, as much as King had some personal characteristics that probably needed some improvement, he was a skirt chaser, and he was a hard drinker, and he, I forget the term, but I think it was something like party time. Whatever happened during party time, would never be mentioned back in the office or back on the ship. That was a time where anybody could do anything, including Admiral King. But when the office time came, he was probably as hard a driver and as towering a figure as anybody in World War II. And, he was part of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he had a way of fudging, or not fudging, but manipulating things so that he would get his way, and included getting his way with people like George C. Marshall, who was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who had, for his own part, had to work with Douglas MacArthur, who had once been George Marshall's superior. So King was able to kind of manipulate those situations to the advantage of the Navy and get his way for, he saw the war in the Pacific as the Navy's war and not the Army's war. And he wasn't about, for example, to give Douglas MacArthur any control of his fleet or his, especially his aircraft carriers. Very interesting figure, underappreciated, but really a towering figure in World War II.
Has, after Midway, when we many of the Japanese aircraft carriers were taken out.
Many of ours were as well.
We had more on the way as we discussed earlier. The Japanese were kind of stuck at that point, weren't they, with fewer carriers and using much more in the land based world.
Right.
And I got the impression, and I think we've always kind of underestimated their abilities as far as their bombers and stuff go. Did you look at their capabilities along those lines at all, and how they ended up fighting the war, given the hand they got dealt after Midway?
Yeah, I'm not so sure how closely I looked at that. I know that the Betty bombers were very active as land-based attacking aircraft. And had a good deal of success in the days after Midway. I mean, I think after Midway, the deck was truly stacked against the Japanese, although I will say that, you know, at the time of Guadalcanal, there was a time when the Navy's carrier, U.S. Navy's carrier force in the Pacific was down to one carrier. I know that the Mitsubishi Bettys played a real role in using the tactics that the Japanese could bring to hand, which was basically they had more of a night flying capability than did the Americans, and they used their Betty bombers as kind of sappers to ferret out and try to attack and destroy the American carriers.
In a modern context, especially in the Marine Corps side, but we're seeing the discussion more today on the Navy side about trying to get less bureaucratic and more of a mindset of battle-mindedness. And when I think of World War II and our leaders when it comes to battle-mindedness, and you mentioned his name, that's why it propped in my head, Admiral Halsey, it seems to be a fashion that people want to judge him by a couple of card decisions that he had to make towards the end of the war. But at the beginning of the war, he was an absolutely critical person. If you could, has history really been kind or looked at Admiral Halsey and appreciated him enough? And if you could, just give us a snapshot of his importance from a leadership perspective early on in the war.
Yeah, you know, I think in the case of Admirals Halsey and Spruance, and you know, during the mid part of the war and to the later stages of the war, they kind of traded off command of the fleet forces, Navy's fleet forces in the Pacific. It was a case of, you know, different horses for different courses. And when you looked at Halsey, you know, he was kind of blunt and, you know, very attack-minded. And, you know, when he came into command, he actually moved out of the Southwest Pacific. And when he had control of the fleet forces during the Battle of Guadalcanal, he was absolutely what was needed, somebody who was always aggressive, willing to take chances and to live with the consequences of those chances. As the war ground on, however, sometimes he could be put in the wrong situation. I think the kind of the classic example would be the Battle of the Philippine Sea, which concludes my book. And in that particular battle, Spruance was in control of the fleet forces and kind of held them back from chasing after the Japanese forces after the Marianas turkey shoot. And if Halsey had been in his seat at that time, he would have attacked. Conversely, during the battle for Leyte Gulf, somebody like Halsey, who was ever ready to go after the Japanese carriers, was put in a situation where, you know, I think it's hard to escape that he made either a bad decision or a faulty decision to go on the attack against carrier forces that really weren't that substantial, while leaving the back door open for an attack by Japanese surface units. So, you know, if Halsey had been in charge at the first battle of the Philippine Sea, and Spruance had been in charge at the second battle, the Battle of Leyte Gulf, it might have done good for the reputations of both. And, of course, you know, Halsey, and this kind of connects with the lady as well, had the you know, unfortunate circumstance to be in command during what's been called Halsey's typhoon, and then a later typhoon, either in the closing months of the war or immediately after the war, that kind of tarnished his reputation. So, you know, it becomes a matter of circumstance. He was certainly the best choice for the struggles early in the war, but as the war went on, he had some vulnerabilities.
Well, I hate to get away from these personalities because a lot of them are really fascinating people, but let's talk a little bit about torpedo planes and their evolution during this war, because when the U.S. got involved in World War II, our torpedo bombers were not much use. And how did they evolve?
Well, just as the war was beginning, Grumman was, in fact, on the day that Pearl Harbor was attacked, Grumman was having a party that day for its employees, and the object of the party was both a new factory that they had moved into and the introduction of the Grumman Avenger, what became the primary torpedo bomber for the substance of the war. And what was in place, even up to the time of Midway, were torpedo aircraft, I think from Douglas, that were slow, inferior, and poorly armed, and those were the ones that got involved so tragically in Midway. So that was a case where timing was everything. Given 6 or 8 more months, the Avenger would have been online, and the TBD Devastator, I think it was called, wouldn't have met such a tragic end in the Battle of Midway.
Sticking on the theme, you look at the aircraft, you know, designs of World War II. A couple of the iconics are the Wildcat / Hellcat and the Corsair. And you had that nice progression of Grumman from the Wildcat, the Hellcat, to the Bearcat, though the Bearcat never really made it in time for the war. But when you move the clock forward to Korea, there's no Hellcats, there's no Bearcats. The Corsair, though, was a very critical aircraft during the Korean War. What was it about the successive development of the Corsair that gave it such a longer operational life than really its contemporary, which was the Hellcat, and then the Bearcat that came after the Hellcat?
Right. Well, I guess at the time of the Korean War, Grumman was, you know, for the Navy at least, making the transition into carrier-based jets. The Corsair, although it was a highly prized aircraft during World War II, had some problems when it came to adaptability for aircraft carrier use. I think that was one of the other strong features of the Grumman aircraft, was that in terms of pilot visibility when landing on a carrier, it was a lot better in Grumman aircraft than it was in the Chanceforth Corsair. So the Corsair had some limitations on visibility, and in fact, one of the reasons that the Corsair had a gull wing was basically to elevate the aircraft to accommodate the size of the propeller. That in turn reduced the visibility, and I think there was also some stall characteristics in the Corsair that made it tricky to land on a carrier. Obviously, on a carrier landing, you have to come in at into the wind, and you have to come in at a very slow speed, so your stall speed has to be very low. And at low stall speeds, the Corsair was a trickier aircraft to fly. But once it did gain, it had quite a following among Marines and eventually did get onto aircraft carriers. So I think it was a little bit behind the Hellcat. And then in terms of Korea, it was still going through operational versions. So it was the plane that was available at the time. It was a great munitions, gun platform for firing from. And it was rugged and had a powerful engine, so it was ended up being perfect for a lot of the Navy's work in the Korean War, which was not so much trying to fly fighter aircraft as it was to provide close ground support to the Marines and to the Army.
When you were a surface warfare guy, I guess. Well, me too. When you start out to write these books on nasal radiators, what surprised you in the things you learned about as you went along writing this book?
Well, one of the things that I sort of knew it, but didn't really appreciate it, was that in the early stages of U.S. Navy aviation. There was a strong use of enlisted pilots. And in Japanese naval aviation, there was a predominant use of enlisted pilots. So it was real kind of different philosophy about who should be controlling the planes in the air. During the early stages of World War II, in terms of the U.S. Navy's aviation, it was former enlisted personnel flying as aviators who got field commissions who were doing a lot of the heavy fighting in the first battles of the war and certainly were the most experienced pilots. So I guess it was a surprise to me that the way the use of enlisted pilots that really kind of extended up through the Korean War when that kind of phased out.
Yeah, I think that figure of 90% for the Japanese really kind of set me back. And it's interesting, the last few years, the Navy and the patrol community and in the helo community is experimenting with flying LDOs and warrant officers now.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think they'll go back to flying enlisted. But another thing that you can pull out while reading the book, when you look at, little Johnny Thatch, little Jimmy Thatch.
Jimmy Thatch, right.
Yeah, Jimmy Thatch. By age 35, he had had tours in patrol aircraft, scout aircraft,
right,
fighter squadrons. In addition to being a test pilot, he had a tremendous amount of flight experience under his belt, where
right,
at age 35, your modern naval aviator, even if he was an instructor pilot, he's just been in one airframe, much
right,
less experience as an aviator, almost more stovepiped with other career requirements. We had a CO of a squadron auger his plane in Afghanistan who hadn't even met his minimum flight requirements for over a year because he was so focused on other things. When you look at their officer development, you talk about how Buair got a lot done because it was young. It had
right,
a bunch of lieutenant commanders. It was small, and they moved pretty fast. Are there some of the personnel or officer development habits that we had in that pre-war period that you think might be worth revisiting, or is it something that's just best left behind?
You may know better than I have a sense that that's a time that has passed us by. I mean, I think one of the interesting things when you compare the U.S. Navy aviators and the Japanese naval aviators during World War II, and one of the things I tried to point out by using the experience of that Japanese pilot was that in the space of basically 3.5 years, when it came to U.S. naval aviators, you basically had three generations of pilots. You had people like Jimmy Thatch, who were in charge of squadrons going into the war, and they were able to mentor people like Butch O'Hare, second generation, And Butch O'Hare, you know, before his untimely death during the war, was able to mentor the generation that included Alex Brashu. And that was, I think, kind of unique to the Navy at the time, and I don't think I'm not sure that's possible anymore. I mean, that's how quickly things moved, and the strides that were made, and it was all because we were in an all-out conflict over an extended period of time that people got to have this level of combat experience, battle-tested experience. I'm not sure that that's possible anymore under these circumstances. At least, you know, at least in the field of naval aviation.
Did it help those pre-war pilots that they spent some time in the fleet before they went to flight school? When I was first commissioned, that a lot of the rule was that you were supposed to go spend a year or so before you got into flight school, which of course changed shortly after that. But do you think that helped those guys?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, at the time it was that you had to go out into the fleet, you had to be on a battleship, and you know, a fighter pilot's job is a young man's job, and I think you're better off getting them into flight training right off the bat, especially if they have to be officers, and you're going to be an officer at say 21. Why waste two years kicking around a surface ship when, you know, you ought to be taking advantage of your skills and your reflexes?
As you mentioned at the beginning, you made a conscious decision to end your book with the story about Task Force 58 and that great battle. What was so significant in a pivot point for that battle in 1944, and is that why you chose to end the book at that point?
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. I think for a dramatic impact, that's a great that's a great ending point, because of over 2 days you had the Marianas turkey shoot, and then you had that incredible mission beyond darkness the next day. But I think even more fundamentally, that was a point where you could reasonably say that that naval aviation truly controlled the skies over the Pacific. Now, I know that, you know, there were months to go before the war was over, and you had the experience of the kamikazes, and you had the Fifth and Third Fleet on the offensive flying over Japan. But when it came to controlling the skies, and, you know, the book is titled Pacific Air, it was really the first battle of the Philippine Sea where that reached its climax.
Well,
in a dramatic fashion.
Let me recommend to people this book, Pacific Air, is a great book, and that they ought to take the opportunity to read it when they get a chance.
That's a great Christmas gift.
it surely does. But let me. What are you working on now, David? What do you got in the works? And what can we
Well, I kind of hesitate to say, because you never have a book until you have a contract to do the book. But I've kind of focused my attention on the Vietnam War, and I'm not ready to say whether it's surface, land, or air. Maybe a combination of all three.
Those would pretty much sum up the choices, wouldn't they?
Well, I tell you what, Dave, I got about 100 pages of your book left to read. I'm looking forward to finish it up, though, as is usual, I cheat ahead and read about a page out of every 25
sure.
going forward.
Sure, yeah, I understand. You don't have to read it, you have to buy it.
Exactly. Yep, that's a fact. I always have to cheat, but we definitely look forward to seeing you next. And thanks a lot this Sunday for coming to join us. Really appreciate it, David.
You're welcome.
Thank you, David.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us live on MidRats, and we hope to see you again. Until then, have a great Navy Day.
Like money. alone, he wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to Rome, it's a long way.